This episode is brought to you by Hot Dish Productions, an award-winning modern culinary production company. Learn more at hotdishproductions.com.
This week on Meat & Three, we celebrate Asian American and Pacific Islander Heritage Month with an episode about memory.
I've always read and sort of approached cookbooks for more than the recipes. To me, they are full of narrative content and narrative value.
So Malama Aina basically means to take care of the land. For us as Hawaiians, it's taking care of our older sibling.
But I do remember definitely feeling self-conscious about it, being the only one who kind of wasn't eating a sandwich and didn't have a bag of goldfish or Lunchables.
Listen to Meat & Three wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome to Feast Your Ears. I'm Harry Rosenblum, and I love to talk with people about what they do and how it influences their personal food stories. This is a show about people, life, and food. If you're just tuning in for the first time, all the previous episodes can be found in the archives at heritageradionetwork.org. I'm thankful for listeners like you, and I'd love it if you'd leave me a review wherever you find this podcast. For those of you with kids at home, I'd like to be so bold as to suggest that you check out my other podcast. Along with my co-host, Hannah Forden, the program manager at HRN, we've created Time for Lunch, a fun, food-focused show for kids. We'd love it if you'd check it out wherever you get your podcasts. I'd also like to remind listeners that Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit, and we need your help to stay on the air. If you enjoy this show and listen to the other great podcasts we produce every week, please find your way to heritageradionetwork.org/donate to make your gift. Today's theme, how to recover from having a restaurant. It's a tough job. Being the chef, the plumber, the greeter, the boss, the banker, the HR department. Sometimes I wonder why anyone would go into business, especially being a chef and restaurant owner. But there's a ton of beauty and fun and guts and experiences there as well. As a serial entrepreneur, I can say that sometimes the hard work feels worth it, and sometimes you feel like Sisyphus pushing the rock up the hill only to have it roll down again. So you go back to the bottom and start pushing again and again. My guest today is someone I've admired for a long time. His food and style of cooking and feeding people has influenced innumerable meals I've eaten. Peter Hoffman calls himself a recovering restaurateur. His memoir, which is also a cookbook titled What's Good, a memoir in 14 ingredients, hit stores on June 8th of this year. It's a healthy serving of great recipes, stories, and more from Peter's 26 years at the helm of Savoy, Back 40, and Back 40 West. And it's about his journey, which of course is ongoing. We spoke this morning for just over an hour, and I felt like we just scratched the surface. I look forward to more conversations with Peter in the future.
I'm Peter Hoffman. I was a chef, restaurateur, operator for over 26 years in Soho, Manhattan, and in the East Village. I ran Savoy and then Back 40 and Back 40 West. And in 2016, I closed up those restaurants and spent the last five years both doing projects, but mostly focused on writing a book, which is called What's Good, a memoir in 14 ingredients. And that's about to be published.
Yeah, it comes out here in a couple of weeks on June 8th.
That's right.
So let's jump in and talk about the book, and then maybe we'll work backwards to talking a little bit about the restaurants and stuff.
Sure.
Did you know from the beginning of the project that it was going to be 14 ingredients? Was it more?
Oh,
or was
no.
it less?
No, that sort of is at the end of the, sort of like, when you're making a recipe in the kitchen, you don't really know the recipe until you're actually done, right? So it's kind of the same thing with the book. I knew in one of the things about the book was that I started out with an idea, which was that I did want to write these chapters about ingredients, and I also kind of wanted to tell my memoir story, but I didn't know what the structure was going to be. And then I read a book called Lab Girl by a woman named Hope Jaron, and she's a botanist professor And I realized that the structure of her book was exactly what I was trying to get at with my life, which in my project, which was moving back and forth between kind of the mechanics of our business and then the passion of the business. So for me, that was, you know, why I love to cook and being inspired by farmers and seasonal local produce or ingredients in general, and what it moves me to create with them. And then, as I said, the business, the mechanics, of being a chef or being a restaurateur, which is, you know, presents so many challenges all the time, that have absolutely nothing to do with cooking.
The mechanics of the business side, I feel like we're living in a time where a lot of that stuff, like the curtain, is pulled back, and where in the last 20 years, with the, you know, proliferation of people following business stories and business radio programs and business magazines and that kind of thing, I think people now in the general public have access to a lot more information about how businesses actually operate than they used to. And there's certainly in the restaurant industry, I mean, I've been reading a lot of what Gabrielle Hamilton's been writing, you know, in the Times, about closing Prune during the pandemic and whether or not she would reopen Prune, and having to figure out how to address some of these issues, like the inequity in pay between front of house and back of house, or, you know, whether or not, like, you should have, like, is a dollar oyster a thing that really makes sense on a menu? Or should you really be talking about how, like, well, we were selling that dollar oyster so we could get you to buy four beers, and we're making money on the beer, so why don't we charge $2 for the oyster? And anyway, all those sorts of pieces.
All those things. I mean, in many ways, what people are looking at, and as you said, more people are understanding, is that the equation, and everyone's perception or acceptance of that general equation, meaning what we're willing to pay for rent and what we're willing to pay, what we price things on the menu as, and what we pay people, all those parts of the equation haven't been working for a long time in the restaurant world, or the restaurant world in New York in particular. And the pandemic made some of that more abundantly clear than it was before. I mean, you know, lots of places were already struggling and going out of business, and I chose to close the business at a time that I did, because in some ways I was kind of burnt out on trying to rejigger that equation, and just didn't have the energy to. I mean, it needed to be reworked, and it needed to be worked not just internally for the business, but in many ways the whole landscape needed to be reworked in terms of what people's perception of, oh, you know, he's charging that much, you know, I mean, you know, I can get it for, you know, only 15, I can get a double thick pork chop for $15 down the street.
Right.
And you go, yeah, right.
I mean, yeah, we used to run into
the backstory on that.
Yeah, we used to run into that at the Brooklyn Kitchen all the time, where people would say, my God, you're charging $6.99 for a dozen eggs. But at the supermarket, they're 99 cents for a dozen.
Yeah. And you go, well, what is that egg? And what is that chicken? And what's happening to the land? And who was collecting those eggs? And
how much did they get paid? And are their families able to live? And are they living in a house and going to school? Or are they living in a trailer? You know, what's the...
Yeah,
what are all the real costs
here? So some of that, you know, the farm to table movement brought a lot of that to the forefront, and that that greater transparency continues and has moved into the equity conversation, not just the environmental conversation, but so the pandemic exposed a lot of that in terms of businesses here in New York, or restaurant businesses, and also what their kind of comorbidities of different businesses were. You know, to use the the term in terms of, you know, people who died of COVID, you know, they had underlying conditions. Well, the restaurants that died of COVID had underlying conditions as well. It's been huge. It's going to continue to be a huge recalibration.
Yeah. So, you know, on your LinkedIn profile, you're listed as a recovering restaurateur.
Yeah, I wrote that a few years ago, you know, because I, as I said, I got burnt out. I just didn't, I didn't have the energy to retool yet again. And I had lost touch with not so much in my interest, but in the demands. I had lost touch with the love of cooking and the love of the ingredients, you know, in the way that I was talking about, that the book is structured between the business and the passion. And you said something about the fact that some people are able to kind of structure their businesses where the person solving those issues isn't necessarily the creative person.
Right.
I never figured that out, or I never tried to construct it in that way. You know, I there's a place where I really liked the fact that I was this wonderful jack of all trades, that I could be the artist and the businessman.
Yep.
I liked that vision of myself, and so I never kind of was like, well, I'm going to be the mad scientist in the kitchen and let somebody else run the business for me, and I'm just going to be the creative force. I wanted to be the messaging force and the cultural driver, as well as you know, coming up with the menu items. I mean, in time, I delegated lots of those responsibilities, both in the kitchen and operational responsibilities, but I still remained a creative director.
Sure.
But that was, that had, you know, that had its price. And so that, well, I said, I just didn't want to retool yet again, given the landscape of increased rents and or the rent that I chose to pay and undertake being there in Soho, given what Soho had become.
Yeah, when you opened Savoy in 1990, right?
Yep.
You know, was that metric the same and prices were just lower? Like, had New York already become a place where, you know, what we would look at now, I mean, from like a, you know, if an MBA class took a look at what it takes in 2021 or what it took in 2019 to run a restaurant in New York, they probably would look at it and say it's not a good business choice for the most part.
Correct.
In 1990, were those metrics already in that vein? Or
it'd be interesting to sort of do that analysis. But I think that, I don't think that, that it's just that. You know, I think that, that overall the cost of doing business became a greater portion of revenues, and it became, and sort of in the perception, and some of it is about you know, you're competing with people who are buying cheap ingredients or paying people poorly,
right?
So that you can get a $15 bowl of pasta, you know, or as your whole dinner, you know, that, that you're competing with that all the time. So did our prices really rise in a manner that was commensurate with the rise in expenses? And to that, I think probably not.
Right.
You know, it's just like, I always bridled when I, you know, there were certain barriers of, you know, there was no entree on the menu when we opened in 1990 that was over $20. And so, you know, tipping that barrier was one. And,
sure.
And then, you know, and then you go, wow, when you first go over $25 and you're saying I'm charging $26 for the duck dish or
right.
Whatever. And then you watched other restaurants start to charge 32 for a veal chop or whatever. You go 32. Right. Wow. You know, and, you know, and so I never priced things on the menu with chutzpah. You know, I was never the guy who said, I'm going to charge. This is the number, folks. If you want that fucking great steak, or you're going to have to pay, you're going to have to really pay for it.
Yeah.
I was always reticent because you're fighting, as I said, you're fighting with the guy down the street who's going to give it for less money. And I never sort of built the restaurant as an exclusive house. And that's part of it too. I mean, intentionally, I never wanted to be that kind of temple of gastronomy that you can, where you bow down to dinner. And so that then people, accept the fact that it's an outrageous price. I want it to be a place to go for dinner.
Right.
And it was
excellently for a very long time.
It was, a wonderful place to go for dinner. And in fact, a breath of fresh air in comparison to some of the pretentiousness that comes along with those higher priced places. And we provided a atmosphere where people could be themselves and breathe and enjoy their friends and do it over a wonderful meal and a great bottle of wine.
Yeah, absolutely. Do you still go to the farmers market in Union Square as often as you used to?
All the time.
Yeah.
It's still and in the pandemic, the farmers market was my community. I mean, it was like I was in the house because we were hiding from everybody and we were suspicious and frightened of everybody. And certainly nobody with everybody, like, you know, occasionally we would go to the supermarket, but it was this paranoid experience in the beginning, you know, in April and May, and people would, even if I wasn't paranoid, people would look at me and go like, you got too close to me. What is the matter with you? You know? And so the experience in the Green Market was, number one, I continued to be able to get the ingredients that I wanted to cook with, but it was also a place to be outside and stand 6 feet away from people and that I knew and have a conversation about, you know, politics or food and the world. So it was my lifeline. And it has remained that as it's been for a long time. I'm still shopping there a lot and feeling really grateful for its continued presence.
Yeah, it is a really incredible community. And I feel like even, you know, even though during the pandemic I didn't spend a lot of time in the city, you know, I was back and went to our local farmers market in Greenpoint, Williamsburg. And, you know, you see the same people and they're still there and they're still producing great food and you get to chat with them and stuff. And it's really a wonderful, wonderful opportunity.
Yeah.
What are some things that there must be things, even though you're still recovering from being a restaurateur, that you miss about having the restaurant or restaurants?
Well, I guess the first thing that comes up is that was a great community as well. Mm-hmm. You know, you on one hand, you don't pick your customers. They pick you. But in fact, the style of your place, the everything from, you know, your aesthetic choices and your pricing, but the feeling of being there and the manner of service and all of that, you're setting something up in terms of what kinds of people feel comfortable there, and so you are selecting your crowd to a certain extent. But it became such a wonderful, wonderful community of people, and I miss that. I miss having, in many ways, the dining room was the extension of my living room or my home dining room, and walking through and seeing people and stopping by the table and having a conversation, or, you know, telling somebody that there's something new and wonderful on the menu or on the wine list that they shouldn't miss out on, or hearing that they're really appreciating some aspect of what it is. So it was very much a conversation that I had with a very wide community. And so I missed that. I took a lot of personal energy from that.
Right.
And that was an impetus then for continuing to be creative. And, you know, sometimes it turned into, you know, sort of the pressure of we have to be creative to stay above water. But really at the heart, the good impetus was I want to continue to share the beauty, the discoveries, the flavors with people, and that I'm excited about that.
This episode is brought to you by Hot Dish Productions, an award-winning modern culinary production company specializing in creative digital video, photography, and podcast production. From concept through post-production, Hot Dish creates and produces compelling food stories that ignite the chef in all. Hot Dish Productions has deep connections to award-winning and celebrity chefs and over 20 years' experience. Their team has won both a James Beard Award and an IACP award for their work in food media. Hot Dish Productions delivers the highest quality product at a fair value. Let them help tell your culinary story today. Explore their work and learn more at hotdishproductions.com.
So then you've been pouring your energy into your book.
Yep.
And it must feel great to have it finally be going out into the world after many years of work.
It does feel great.
It's a different timeline, of course, than producing a meal, right?
Yeah.
You know, producing a dish in the kitchen, you know, even if there are, some actions that need to happen, either fermentation or other sorts of things ahead of time, the dish doesn't take years necessarily to send out to the end user.
Mm-hmm. Totally. But I took certain things that I had learned in terms of how to work in the kitchen, you know, whether it's your daily mise en place or longer term projects, and applied it to the book. I had a work list. That was what I had, it morphed, but it was basically, these are the chapters that I want to write. And there was a paragraph or a couple of loose sentences about what that chapter was about. But then I didn't really know what the chapter was going to be, and I couldn't lay it out. It's not what the book is, or it's not the way that I worked as a writer, or whatever. Some people know all that stuff, but what was so for me, then I would sit down and I'd say, okay, I'm writing this chapter about leeks and potatoes, and the point of that chapter was, you know, in a certain way to say, this is what the green market looks like in March. You know,
right.
It's not just about the glory of peppers and eggplant and tomatoes and peaches and raspberries and all of that. And isn't it fabulous, you know, and every Instagram post is just, you know, the glory of it all. It's like, okay, what do you want to say about that rough moment? And also just to be clear, you know, it's just like, so at one time, that time in the season when it's about eggplant and peppers and peaches, it's all about the freshest, the most fragile, ingredients that you need to cook now and do the least to, and maybe all you're doing is slicing them and sprinkling some salt and pepper on them, and that's the glory. We're in the moment, and this is the pit of its peak ripeness.
Right. It's so fleeting.
So fleeting, right? And you go to the far extreme in March when what you're cooking is things that are all about, they're there because they're all about storage.
Yep.
There's nothing fleeting about it. And the cooking that's required is, longer cooking. It may be slow cooking, but it's about, I'm using the cooking techniques to make accessible or release the flavors of something that by its very nature doesn't want to release it. It's right. There in March, available to me because the intelligence of the plant is about storage.
Yeah.
And so that's kind of like, just that is kind of amazing to me, you know, to have that thought and go like, oh, that's brilliant, you know, brilliant from an evolutionary standpoint. And we humans have kind of, you know, tricked the plant or figured it out or whatever. And so we can hold the potatoes in a storage, cold storage place, and then bring them to market and access them so that we can eat them now. We didn't have to, you know, one of the things about a lot of animals and certain indigenous peoples is that they followed the seasons, right? They migrate. We figured out how not to migrate. And part of that is that we figured out how to live off of the plants that store energy over a longer period of time. So I don't know, it's a long way of sort of talking about the leek and potato chapter, but yep. what I was really talking about was that I found my way as a writer by kind of improvising as I would in the kitchen over a recipe. I didn't know what I was going to end up with until I had it. And so like all these ideas that I've just been riffing with you about, I was riffing on the page until I went like, okay, now let me cut and paste and rebuild. And now that I know the thread of the conversation, produce that in a way that makes sense to the reader in terms of going like, oh yeah, potatoes, aren't they amazing?
That makes a ton of sense. And it sounds like it really, I mean, it also reflects the way you worked in the kitchen of sort of gathering these things together and then reorienting them or reframing them or putting them together in a slightly different order until you had the finished product.
Yeah. And so I think, or my hope is that when you read that chapter, for instance, that you'll feel my excitement of making those connections. So it's not just like, oh, well, this is an academic study on, the storage capacities of the Solanaceae. You know, right. So it's kind of like, wow, you know, I love potatoes and I love cooking them in duck fat and why, but this is sort of what's my discovery as a writer, as having this pandemic moment to really contemplate the potato.
Yeah.
And again, not to go on about potatoes, but that's one of many chapters in which I kind of focused on these ingredients or this moment in the seasonal moment. And then meditated on that and shared that thinking and backed it up with real science, but again, real science that everybody can understand.
Yeah. And I have to say, I also, as someone who lived in New York in the 90s and early 2000s and saw a lot of change happen there, I really appreciate a lot of the memoir stuff that you've included. Mm-hmm. I love at the end of the chapter about construction is cooking, mm-hmm. that you include the very first ad that you placed. looking for employees,
right.
At a time when, you know, this was you know, it was a print world. Like, you know, you couldn't look on Craigslist. You didn't have a phone. There was no internet to speak of. And so I want to read it because I love the ad.
Please. It is such a wonderful distillation of that moment in time in New York. I love that part of the chapter.
Yeah, too. Absolutely. And down to and including the fact that you don't even need to include an area code because everybody knew that it started with 212. You didn't even need it.
That's right.
So the ad reads, "Cooks, two seasoned chefs opening 45-seat downtown restaurant. Food with guts and beauty. Experienced," which is shortened to EXP'D due to space limitations, I'm sure, in the paper and how much it cost. "Experienced line cook and entry position available." And then there's the phone number, which at the time was the phone number at Savoy, I'm assuming, right? 219-8992?
Yes.
that was a time when, like, you know, it did matter how many letters you put in, and that was going to change the cost because it would have pushed it to four lines instead of three in the paper.
Yeah.
And so that was when opening the business, I'm sure.
Totally. And so the fun thing about that aspect of the chapters is that I talk about, there was a four line minimum. All the ads were that way, so that there are all these abbreviations that now you only see in kind of crossword puzzles, WPFL, is working brick fireplace, three RD, WI, which is a third floor walk up. all that stuff. And we all became completely comfortable with those acronyms, because everybody was trying to, and it cost this is the 1990, it cost $200 to run that four line ad in the Sunday paper only.
Right. It got printed for one day.
One day, everybody knew to buy the Sunday paper if you were, looking for a job.
Yep.
You compare that with, I don't know what the price is now, but most of the years that we were using Craigslist, it was $25 for a posting with unlimited space. You know, you could upload the menu, pictures of the restaurant.
Yeah.
There was a map with a location of where you were. You could go on and on about your place. And it was $25 and you could, post it as many times as you wanted.
I mean, for me, it was a real trip down memory lane because I remember going to brunch in my early 20s in the 90s on Sunday morning with friends, and we each had a copy of the paper, and we were sitting there circling ads and saying, "Oh, this might be good for you, and this might be a good job for you, and you should call this one." It was really like, I have a very clear memory of that.
Yeah. And what it became as well, Eater didn't exist. And so that on a certain level, the Sunday one ad section, and as you said, we all got it over brunch, was the community newsletter. Alfred's about to expand and he's looking for people, and so then that's part of the buzz of what's happening in the food world that some new chef is opening a spot.
So in that ad, where did you come up with the term "food with guts and beauty"?
Thanks for asking, Harry. I don't know, but it really is the. I'll just tell you, I wanted to name the book "Food with Guts and Beauty," and because I felt like it really was the distillation of what I wanted to communicate and have really been trying to communicate for many years, that I wasn't, the guts is, on one hand, you could say, it's about serving awful. But it's about, we're not hiding the process of cooking. And so you could see the kitchen, but we're also not trying to turn the food into something that it isn't. And that part comes from my time in Japan, and that what I was really moved by in Japanese cuisine and the Japanese aesthetic was they weren't, you know, the French do all kinds of cutouts. They, you know, they cut their little brunoise, and then they had the little cutters where they make crescent moons out of carrots and decorate them on the plate and all of that. And that was so not me. Or dots on the plate in concentric circles, you know, and edging lines and stuff like that. The Japanese are all about showing nature on the plate, yep. You know, so that the tops of a turnip or the little root bottom of the turnip, they cherish that. They retain that. They want to remind you that this is food that came out of the earth, came out of the soil. And so those kinds of aesthetic decisions, like I said, you know, taking the time to wash the, to not just cut off all the turnip tops and yet retain them and get the dirt out of it and cook them just so that you could see the lime green of it, the early chlorophyll, that all that was part of what we were going to share with our diners. And so that's the guts and the beauty, you yeah. know, the awe of nature as presented on the plate.
Absolutely. I mean, I also like to, I mean, I would like to offer an interpretation of the guts as well to a little bit in the way that you presented some other things later with your restaurant, you know, like your Passover meals that sort of traveled around based on influence, based on U.S. foreign policy.
Yes.
You know, specifically, sort of, you know, you spent a number of years identifying places that the government was sort of against, you know, as far as Yemen, Afghanistan, Iran, Iraq.
That we had vilified, right?
Yeah. Yeah. Can you talk a little bit about that sort of as a,
sure.
How did that come about? And I, you know, and I have to say, I really, I appreciate that you were using your pulpit, so to speak, you know, to really talk about these things from the restaurant kitchen. I feel like they're, is often not enough people engage in that. I mean, they have a restaurant, they have their menu, they just kind of do their thing and they stay out of politics.
Yeah. Again, thank you for noticing that and appreciating that. I mean, it really became another fundamental principle of who I was and what the restaurant was and important. because I do think that lots of restaurants or restaurateurs or chefs just want to say, I'm just cooking my food. You know, and so the wandering into the political realm, you know, took time. I mean, and there was pushback. I mean, there were times where, you know, when we were, first of all, I mean, you know, so like I got very involved with an organization called Chefs Collaborative. We were termed eco chefs and kind of told that we were kind of being too high and mighty and that it's just like, just cook the food, you know, and that's all that people really want. They just, we're here to show people a good time and don't get heavy. You know, and that getting heavy in terms of what's the story behind our food is antithetical to let's party and have a good time. And that's what restaurants are here to do. Well, mm-hmm. I didn't feel that. I always felt like my restaurant could be, should be on some level a force for change. And, and, you know, and so that got complicated. and, you know, back to the idea about who comes to your restaurant and it's self-selective. It's just like the people who want to be doted on and pay high prices for exclusive ingredients and exclusive experiences, they didn't like my restaurant. And and that's okay.
Sure.
but I also didn't like get that attention or charge those prices and therefore make that money that comes with that kind of experience. So Passover, so I started out, quickly. The Passover thing happened because I wanted to stay open for Passover, and but it still hurt my heart that I wasn't celebrating the holiday. So we kind of threw it together over staff meal. And then I was sort of doing a quick Haggadah, in the 20 minutes that or 30 minutes that staff meal is. And someone said, you should do this, for real. And I was like, yeah, that's a good idea. And it took us a couple of years and then we did it. And then and I was like, well, what am I going to do? And I was like, I'm not doing matzo balls and and brisket. And I realized that here I was cooking the food of the Mediterranean. And I was like, oh, well, there's the Sephardic Jews. I don't know anything about Sephardic cooking. And so it became this wonderful journey for me to learn about the traditional foods of the Sephardic world. And so I started serving that. And it started out as being just kind of pan Mediterranean. I did a little Moroccan dish combined with a Greek or Turkish dish, and then those were the early years. And then I started to focus in on, let me just hop around and dive deeper into particular cuisines. And then, of course, I think the first year was the year that I get lost in time, the Iraqi war, the first Iraqi war.
Right. Yeah, you write in the book that it was Passover 2003, just after the Iraqi invasion.
That's what was coming. Thank you. Yeah. And so I was like, I remember standing in the kitchen, listening to the radio where, we're shooting all these bombs into it. And it's like, what are we doing? What are we doing? And then I was like, okay, what are we going to, what cuisine am I going to do for Passover this year? And I was like, yeah, we're going to cook the food of the people we're bombing.
Yeah.
Now, of course, most Jews had left because of all the Arab-Jewish conflict over the years starting in the 60s.
Yeah.
But that remains. These people, these cuisines, these people, some of them still live there. That is their heritage and their homeland. And I wanted to make sure that everybody was remembering that the act of a government, whether it's the U.S. government or the government of another country that we're demonizing, Iraq in this case, isn't necessarily the view of the people themselves, right? So that I don't agree with the politics of my president sometimes, and therefore those people may not agree with the politics of their president. And so then it's like, well, let's eat their food. Let's get into their head in a certain way and go, that famous, important turning point line in the telling of the Passover story, when the Jews, after the Red Sea floods back over and drowns the Egyptian troops, God says, hold it, don't be celebrating because I drowned those people. Are not these my people too? And so it's important for us to remember that we are all one people on this planet, and these are my people too. And we have to work towards understanding that or being able to really own that. And let's start by doing that by eating the delicious foods of the culture of somebody who we don't really understand yet.
Yeah. I mean, I have to say I'm absolutely blown away by this and want to incorporate this as well, because as you say, in the book, you grew up Jewish, heavy on the ish. And I feel the same way, but we always had Passover and I always had, grandma's brisket or great grandma's brisket, which it turns out came off the back of the Lipton onion soup package I found out years later, but it's still grandma's brisket in my personal canon. It's delicious. You know, but, you know, this makes me think last year during COVID, right after Passover was when things sort of heated up around Breonna Taylor and George Floyd and the Black Lives Matter movement. And I ended up on a group text with a number of people, some of whom I knew well and some I didn't. And somebody on that text chain made some sort of a, you know, quite racist comment. And I happened to know that the person who made, I mean, it was an acquaintance, but I happened to know that they were Jewish. And I said, look, we just had Passover. And we just like retold the story of people being free and, you know, not, you know, of needing to kind of like celebrate that we are all of one people. And the idea of inviting people to your table if they're hungry. I mean, like this, we just talked about all of this stuff. How can you say that? And so for me, what this makes me consider is that I think, you know, in future years, I want to take some of this idea of yours, and whether it be about, you know, related to foreign policy or places that we as a country are bombing that we don't agree with, or whether it's about cooking, you know, traditional food of Black Americans, you know, for Passover, and using that as a way to talk about that with my family and with my children, you know.
Yeah.
It's really powerful.
I'd run with it. Yeah. You know, and that's great. I'm glad that inspired you. You know, and that's what I loved about, you know, you about that opportunity that I had in the restaurant, and that was to share my thinking implicitly and explicitly. Mm-hmm. And people came to love that. I mean, I sort of had the dinner series, and that was sort of adjunct to the Passover kind of thing. It grew out of that. But it was a time to be conscious about what our choices were and discuss it and make clear to interested customers what that was all about, and use it as an opportunity to dive deeper into the issues and learn about them, because there's so much that we didn't know and that we still don't know, and that only happens when you choose to dive into it, to study it. And so I used the restaurant as my educational tool. That was, I felt grateful that I had this, you know, that was my laboratory for exploration and study. You know, again, that wasn't always, you know, it didn't always produce the greatest profits and the greatest efficiency, but you know, I made money there for 25 years, so I think that's pretty good.
Yeah, that's pretty good. So I wanted to ask you as we sort of you know, come close to an ending point here. What's next? I mean, I imagine you have more than one book in you. I don't know if there's another book in the works or if you're doing a book tour for this one.
Well, yeah, thanks for asking. You know, it's interesting. I for a long time, I always just felt like this is it. This is my I'm pouring everything that I know into this single document. And there is no book after that. And then all of a sudden, I mean, there's two parts. You have to pare back the undertaking so that it's not a 500-page book.
Sure.
You know, but also beginning to see the possibility of what another project might be. And so I'm hoping actually that part of what happens this summer is that as I'm on book tour, because I think that people are ready to gather again and be outside. Mm-hmm. It may not be inside bookstores, but it might be on the patios of restaurants or in some public places where, again, we're not sitting down to a formal dinner series type meal, but a cocktail party and a conversation like the one we've just been having in shorter term.
Yep.
So I'm hoping to go around the country. I'm going to be up in Maine and up in the Midwest, sort of Chicago, Madison, Spring Green, and maybe further up. And so I have people, I have ingredients that I'm interested in learning more about, and hoping that I'll sort of combine those trips,
nice.
The book tour trips, with kind of deeper dive into those ingredients, with the hope of writing the next chapters of that part of a second book. So that's what's going on. My website, peterhoffmancooks.com, is going live in the next day or two. And so all my events, book tour, and other projects will be available there, peterhoffmancooks.com.
Nice. And I wanted to also ask, you had mentioned previously to me before this interview about a Spanish festival that you're interested in reproducing. Is that on the...
Well, that's in the book. I mean, that's the calzotada that I did for many years. That's the Spring Leek festival that where they grill over wintered over leeks that start beginning as the days are getting longer, but it's still kind of chilly out, and you eat them by holding the leeks in your hands, dipping them in romesco sauce, and eating, you know, utensil free. And then it moves on to sort of grilled lamb and white beans and Botifarra sausage and lots of wine, stuff like that. So I ran that festival at the restaurant for many, many years. And they were, really bacchanalian events. Everybody got drunk, and there was dancing, and I would hire flamenco guitarists to add to the experience. And that I, even after I closed the restaurant, I did one out at the Wyatt Hotel as to recreate it. And there's a place where that festival wants to live on, and that I can continue to do that.
You should take it to Japan. I would seen lots of overwintered alliums in Japan, I think that would be a really neat place to kind of put those things together.
Yeah, they, I mean, right, that's what they do with those leeks, where that long, long leek that has so much white on it, it's all about pushing the soil up against it and letting it grow slowly with good sun, but non-freezing temperatures. And it's a great idea.
Well, I'll have to recreate the festival here for myself too, because sadly I missed it in the years that it was happening at the restaurant. Well, thank you, Peter. It has been a pleasure and an honor to get to chat with you today.
Well, it's been great talking to you, Harry, you really understood, you understood what's in the book and what some of the deeper implications of it are, and I feel honored that you connected to all of that. So, What's Good is a wonderful read, and I think it moved you, and I think it'll move lots of readers as well. So thanks for taking the time with me today.
Thanks for listening to Feast Your Ears today. You can follow what Peter is up to on social media at Peter Hoffman NYC, or you might find him at the Union Square Green Market, which he frequents. And please check out peterhoffmancooks.com for updates on his book tour, events, and future projects from one of the pioneers of what we now call farm-to-table cuisine. You can find Feast Your Ears, as well as lots of other great shows, at heritageradionetwork.org, on iTunes, Spotify, Pandora, Stitcher, or wherever you get your podcasts. Please reach out to me if you have any questions. You can find me on email, harry@thebrooklynkitchen.com, and you can follow me on Instagram, @thefoodballer. Feast Your Ears is powered by Simplecast. Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Instagram and Twitter, @heritage_radio. You can also find us at facebook.com/heritageradionetwork. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Subscribe to the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join the HRN family by becoming a member. Just click on the heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.